Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Let me tell you what a fine truffle can do. It's sort of a Shaggy Dog story, so stay with me. It was 7 a.m. It was opening day of the truffle market in White Truffle Central. That's the town of Alba in northern Italy. People were milling around in this little shopping arcade, age range maybe 14 to 99. Each person was clutching a crumpled brown paper bag to his bosom, and each would tell me just about any secret except where they found their truffles. So why all this fuss? Well, great truffles grow where they please, not where we please. Hunting down truffles needs a nose. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, you know, for the most part, I'm a law-abiding person, but once I was kicked off a bus in Italy, and it was because of a truffle. It was in Alba in the early 90s, and unbeknownst to me, there was a law that you couldn't carry an unsealed truffle on a public conveyance. That's how intense they smell. In Italy, it's often the white truffle. In France, it's the black truffle, and here in the States, it's both kinds. Wherever they are, they're prized and therefore quite valuable. Now, if you've got a pooch and you're wondering how to refill the coffers, how about putting the pup to work sniffing for the mushroom with the big paycheck? European truffles run $600 to $700 a pound. Now, the pooch is going to need training, and this is where Jim Sanford comes in. Jim is an elephant trainer turned truffle dog man. In fact, he does truffle dog seminars across the country. Jim's part of a truffle project at Tennessee's Blackberry Farm Resort. Jim Sanford, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Jim, you train elephants, and then you start training dogs for truffles. Is this because the elephants perhaps didn't do such a good job? I mean, how do you make this leap?
Well, it kind of surprised me as well. I was an elephant handler and trainer for about 20 years. And if you'd asked me this question 15 years ago, I was convinced that's what I was going to do until the day that I die. But the needs of my family changed, and I was a father first and foremost. So, 10 years ago, I started working here at Blackberry Farm, and I was hired as a fly fishing guide, and I started up a horseback program for them. And then about 3 years ago, we acquired a couple of truffle dogs. And my introduction to these dogs was simply one of my supervisors said to me, "We're getting these two dogs in from Italy next week, and we'd like you to train them to find truffles." I thought, well, that's great. I went home that night and Googled up what a truffle was.
Right.
And that was my introduction to it. Now, of course, training is training. So elephants, horses, dogs, it's all pretty much about the same.
What makes this dog special? Is this a particular breed of dog?
Yeah, this breed, which is called Legato Romagnolo, which Legato refers to of the water. Uh-huh. And Romagnolo comes from that region in northern Italy. And it actually goes all the way back to the 16th century. And back then, it was used primarily as a waterfowl hunting dog. And the dog became, about 200 years ago, the prime candidate for finding truffles. Hmm. Now, of course, pigs, other animals, anything that has a good nose would be able to find a truffle which grows underground. But pigs have a bad habit of wanting to eat the truffles, and you know, they're pretty dear in price, so these dogs really worked out well. Plus, the other thing was, you know, in Europe, where these truffles are native, it's kind of a well-kept secret as to where they might be found. And if you were walking your pig down the street, that might be an indication you're going truffle hunting.
You're right.
Whereas if you've got just a 35-pound dog that's just walking down the street, that's not going to draw that much attention.
So these dogs are trained specifically to find the truffles. So that means you sort of got to start with some truffles first for them to get a scent of the truffle, right?
Yeah, that was how I approached it. Now, when I was asked to do this, I really didn't have a history of training dogs to find truffles, so I just kind of made it up. But I actually put a real black truffle into a sock and put this someplace easy for them to find and rewarded them for putting their nose on it.
Right.
And then eventually I would bury it and they would have to locate it and indicate to me where it is by digging. And this whole process took several weeks, but I have six of these dogs on property right now, and I've got three of them that last winter found 200 pounds of the European black truffle.
Whoa!
That's a lot.
And is that in your neck of the woods, are you saying?
Yes, it is. Now, these truffles grow in a symbiotic relationship with a particular species of tree.
Right.
One of the most common trees is the European hazelnut. And we have about 100 of these trees here on the property at Blackberry Farm. And when they were seedlings, the root system was inoculated with the ectomycorrhiza, which is like the spores of this truffle.
Mm-hmm.
And you put them in the ground, adjust the pH, and wait 5 or 6 years, and you might be getting truffles. And there's a local artisan who's a friend of Blackberry Farm who lives about 100 miles from here, and he started doing this in 2001. And it was on his property that our dogs found the 200 pounds of truffles last year.
That's pretty amazing. Now,
it's very amazing.
Now, you train people and dogs to do this around the country, right?
Well, yeah. I'm actually going to be going to the Oregon Truffle Festival at the end of the month, and I'm putting on a seminar to help people teach their dog how to find truffles, yes.
This is pretty exciting. Jim, thanks so much.
Lynn, it's been my pleasure to speak with you.
Jim Sanford does truffle dog seminars at truffle and mushroom gatherings around the country. He and his dogs are based at Blackberry Farm in Tennessee. You know, there's one more thing about truffles. If you're ever thinking about spending money on a truffle, go for a fresh one. Let me tell you, a fresh truffle, the way you can tell it's really what it should be, its aroma should fill the room, okay? I mean, I actually, at my first truffle mark in Alba, I actually got a truffle headache. That's how intense the smell is. So this is what you want to do. You want to find a great fresh truffle. Usually you're going to find that November through February. And by the way, skip the canned ones. And as far as truffle oil goes, some are good, a lot aren't. I still feel wait for the big guy. Okay, we're going to be talking to you this hour. You can call us at 800-537-5252 or email us via splendidtable.org. But right now we're going to Jeff in Kenai, Alaska, who says he has a pressing issue. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
Oh, you're welcome. What do you want to talk about, Jeff?
Well, I have a chicken problem.
I beg your pardon.
Tell all. Well, I've raised chickens for a couple of years, and usually I've been getting the usual hybrids that most Americans use.
Right.
They grow very fast, but perhaps they're not as good for cooking. And so this year I obtained something called Freedom Rangers. And I didn't know it at the time, but they're spin-offs from the Label Rouge movement in France.
Oh, yeah. Those are really prime chickens.
Right.
Yes, in France, yeah. You pay a lot of money for those chickens in France.
And I didn't do it purposely, but I did, you know, Label Rouge not only selects the genetics, but also the technique for raising them, and free range, et cetera.
Right, right.
And so I raised them. I did well with them and butchered most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were amazing. And that was very straightforward. But I decided I would keep some so that I could perpetuate the strain.
Right.
So I have some extremely large chickens now. middle.
And they're called what? Free Rangers? They sound
they're
like.
They're called Freedom Rangers.
Freedom Rangers. Doesn't this sound like they can form a little squad and go out and fight from right?
Absolutely. And it justice. Sounds like a subdivision of the CIA or something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They're just big brown chickens. And so I was going to keep 10 of them. I kept a rooster and some hens. And they're huge.
Right.
And they don't lay that well. And I might want to keep a few of them to experiment with, but, you know, probably I want to, you know, cull several from the herd.
Right.
But I'm concerned now that I have these huge chickens that are older than you would normally butcher, perhaps how to cook them to deal with what's probably going to be a tougher meat.
How old are they?
At this point, they're probably about 6 months old.
Uh-huh. Do you know what you've got? You
have got... No.
You have got what most of us have to pay a lot of money for.
Right on.
Yeah, you have got the chicken that was meant for dishes like coq au vin and chicken and dumplings and all kinds of stews. And you have got the chicken that will make a soup the likes of which you will be on your knees weeping with joy. You will want to stock the freezer because that mature meat is so delicious. And yes, it's, you know, it's not something you flash roast and you get it tender and juicy. You need to cook it really slow. The very first home-cooked meal I ever ate on my very first trip to France was a woman who kept her chickens for a very long time specifically because she would make the old dishes. Take any chicken stew recipe that looks interesting to you from any culture. I mean, it could be Thailand, it could be France, you know, it could be anywhere. And do a real slow, slow bubble on them. It'll take an hour. It may take 2 hours. But it will be so delicious. The way that meat is going to just be mouth-filling and luscious, it will be a whole new experience in chicken.
Perfect. Well, I'm excited.
My mouth is watering at the thought. And it's
well,
so
great.
You know, it's so interesting though, because you talk about the fact that this chicken genetically is essentially an older breed, and it's, you know, in France there's some very specific rules about certain breeds and how they're raised and the age that they meet their demise and all of that. But I remember a long, long time ago when I worked in New York City, and I was doing a food program, and we had a chicken soup contest, and the woman who won was an old Jewish lady who made the most incredible chicken broth you can imagine. And in those days, there were still live poultry markets. And when she was asked what her secret was by a New York Times reporter, she said, "You have to have a chicken with gray feathers." But it turned out that I can't remember the breed, but that chicken with gray feathers was one of those very old breeds that had not been crossed with very much. It was a very old style chicken. I don't even know if it's still available, but her, you know, she was right on. So you've sort of done the same thing. I would say you are in from some wonderful eating.
Oh, I'm thrilled to try it out.
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of serious cooks out there, and not so serious cooks are going to be really envious.
Cool.
Jeff, thanks so much for the call.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
The state of American food, from Italian truffle hounds in Tennessee to French chickens in Alaska. Look, those are prime chickens, and you pay a fortune for them in France. Now, I should mention that any stew recipe can be done with a mature chicken, a.k.a. a stewing hen. Now, when you have a moment, scan the recipe collection on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our weeknight kitchen e-newsletter, show podcasts, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, at last, the goodness of the food matches the beauty of the countryside. It's the new Irish country cooking and the New Orleans secret sandwich. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Never waste a meal. I mean, it is so tempting when you're traveling just to grab anything at hand, but you could be missing the most amazing tamales or barbecue just down the road. Well, this is why we check in with Jane and Michael Stern. They've been tracking great American hometown cooking for 3 decades. Hey, Jane, Michael, welcome.
Good to be here.
Hey, Lynn.
Have you guys gotten back to New Orleans recently?
Multiple times. You know, every spring we now do the New Orleans Road Food Festival, where cooks come from all over the country to do their specialties. And we also have a lot of great New Orleans specialties. And one of the ones we're going to be having this spring is roast beef po' boys from the Parkway Bakery. Now, you know, when you think of po' boys in New Orleans, you probably think of shrimp po' boys and oyster boats all the great seafood, and there's nothing wrong with any of that. But one of the lesser-known treasures of New Orleans is its fabulous roast beef po' boys. And what's great about them is that the roast beef is more like a kind of pot roast. I mean, fall apart tender, lots of natural gravy, and tons of what they call debris. You and I might call it debris, meaning all the little bits and pieces and fatty parts that come off the roast when you slice it, piled into the roll along with the beef. It is to die for.
There are many, many things that that city and Louisiana has contributed to this country's culture. But debris has got to be at the top of the list. It's wonderful brown crunchins. Because I've seen it mentioned and used, not just obviously in Po' Boys, but Paul Prudhomme built a whole dish around the idea. And this is spectacular.
The burnt ends. And,
yeah.
Now, my favorite, I have to say, Michael, I do love the roast beef there. But my absolute favorite po' boy is the gravy po' boy.
Because it's got so much debris in
it. It's the entire roast beef po' boy without the roast beef on it.
But there's so much beef, and the bread is so sopped with that beef flavor. I mean, you don't even miss the fact that there's no meat in it.
Now, is this a restaurant or is this a bakery?
It's called Parkway Bakery and Tavern, and it's really neither a bakery nor a tavern. You know, this is New Orleans, so it doesn't make a lot of logical sense, but it's wonderful. In fact, they don't make their own bread. It's from one of the great, French bread bakeries in New Orleans. And it's like impeccably fresh. It's a restaurant and you order at the window. You pick up your sandwich and bring it to a table. And if you order that sandwich that Jane loves, the gravy po' boy, which is, by the way, $3.65 for more than you could possibly eat.
For about a foot long sandwich.
You pick it up at the window and it's wrapped in like several layers of butcher paper. By the time you get it to the table, the gravy is leaching through the butcher paper. So needless to say, it's not a neat and tidy sandwich.
Who wants neat and tidy when you can have that? Mm.
I'm drooling.
I know I always ask this question, and why would I in this situation, but is there anything else that's sort of a specialty there?
Well, they have, a lot of good things. Don't they have pulled pork?
They have all kinds of different po' boys.
Seafood.
I don't know if there's anything on the menu other than po' boys. There may indeed be. You know my favorite? Aside from the roast beef and aside from the gravy, they have breakfast po' boys as well. But the one that I love, and it's so improbable I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, are you ready? It's the surf and turf po' boy, which is the beef, the gravy, and crunchy fried shrimp that somehow, miraculously, do not in the least bit sog out from all that gravy. They still remain real crunchy and golden and crisp along with the beef and gravy. It's like, it's sort of ridiculously rich, but irresistible.
Sounds wonderful. Guys, thank you.
Welcome, Lynn.
Soda long and dash the coupe Chevrolet. Jimmy the crack of the doodad he got.
And Michael Stern of roadfood.com are authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can find the Stern's Road Food Finds anytime. Just go to the trusty website, splendidtable.org. Ireland has gone from a beautiful country with not very beautiful food to a place travelers go to purposely to eat. That's what food writer Coleman Andrews started doing, almost in spite of himself, at least in the beginning. He then became so beguiled, he felt that the world should know what's happened in Ireland over the past 20 years. Coleman has done The Country Cooking of Ireland. Coleman, welcome.
It's nice to be here.
Where did this bad rap for Irish food come from?
Well, I think it came from the fact that Irish food has been really bad for a long time. Ireland, though, historically, as I found when I started doing research for this book, had a rich food culture, extremely rich, and all the old legends and stories are full of descriptions of the abundance and quality of food. I think what happened in the simplest terms is an archaeologist I know in County Tipperary who has a special interest in food. The way he expressed it to me is he said, Ireland lost its food culture when the Irish lost ownership of their land. And they lost ownership of the land because the English came in and basically said, the land belongs to us now.
This was back in what, the 1500s?
Yes, exactly. Originally. And then it's a very complicated history ever since then. And it's gone back and forth. And for many long periods, the Irish were forbidden to own land in their own country, as strange as that may seem now.
All right. But now the food of Ireland, we've been hearing for what, maybe a decade, that the food of Ireland is delicious, it's wonderful, it's a rebirth. So what's happened?
Well, a number of things. I think the establishment of an independent country once and for all early in the 20th century had a lot to do with reviving Irish pride in its own traditions. And now I think people really they have a strong cultural sense of their own identity, and the language is reviving and everything else. And along with that, Ireland became in the late 20th century one of the most robust economies in the world. So there was wealth, there was international travel on the part of the Irish, and they'd come back home wanting food of the quality maybe that they had in France or Italy or Tokyo or Singapore or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I always joke that a typical modern Irish menu always has the words lemongrass and spring roll on it because there's a great love for Asian food, too, that's been worked into Irish cooking.
But this book, there's not a bit of lemongrass in this whole book.
No, not a bit.
And this book is focused on country food.
That's right, which I define fairly broadly because really all Irish cooking is all traditional Irish cooking really is country cooking.
The food is so simple, though. I mean, I'm looking at this. There's green herbs, dairy, pork, vegetables, but not a lot of spicing. I mean, this seems to be very ingredient dependent.
It is very ingredient dependent. And people say that the most important single thing grown in Ireland is grass. And that grass is rich in nutrients and very, very abundant. And it's a perfect climate because Ireland, as everyone knows, is kind of damp. But it's rarely very cold. It's more or less a temperate climate. So it's a perfect combination of factors to grow this wonderful fodder, which in turn means you have delicious tasting lamb and beef and so forth. But also what has always been the greatest strength of Ireland in terms of food are the dairy products, the milk and cream and butter and cheese and so forth.
But I'm looking, one of the major vegetable sections here is the potato, the famous Irish potato.
No surprise there.
But, you would think after the potato famine and such tragedy connected with this vegetable that people wouldn't want to go near it.
Well, I think it was almost the opposite. I mean, once the issue of the blight that affected potatoes was, it is still an issue, but once that was brought into control and once the crops diversified more, the Irish genuinely love the taste of potatoes. And they were the first country in Europe to really embrace the potato as a common vegetable, to the extent that there was a great report from an English traveler in the early 19th century who said he estimated that a typical Irish family of husband, wife, and four children consumed about 37 pounds of potatoes a day.
A day?
A day. And I had, when I turned this manuscript in, the copy editor queried that, surely some mistake. And I said, No, not a mistake, 37 pounds a day. To put that in a different perspective, that family of six people, they could be fed for a year on 1 acre of potatoes. The potatoes grew so well, when they did grow, And they were also very nutritious. And this is something that was a surprise to me when I started doing the research because, of course, I raised two young daughters and I spent most of my last 15 years or so saying potatoes aren't vegetable. I want you to eat a vegetable, a green vegetable, you know, whatever.
Only
to find out that potatoes actually, if you have to limit yourself to just one vegetable, they're one of the best choices you can make.
Tell me about how the Irish do their potatoes. I'm looking at Culcannon. First of all, why don't you explain what Culcannon is?
Sure. Well, Culcannon in the simplest form, and it's done with slight variation, but it's basically potatoes mashed with kale and then with lots of butter and cream.
But the potatoes are what? They're boiled and then
They're boiled in their jackets. Most of the Irish are very firm about that. I know a lot of people who will peel and chop up their potatoes before they boil them. But they think that then they absorb too much moisture, too much water that way. So it's better to boil them in their jackets.
And then it's mashed with the butter and the cream and the kale goes in.
Exactly.
Are modern cooks taking this to kind of new heights?
Oh, sure. I mean, this and a lot of other traditional dishes. And one of the things that kind of makes a lot of the Irish laugh is kind of a trendy dish is a Culcannon cappuccino. So they basically make the Culcannon and then liquefy it a little bit with additional cream or some stock and then serve it in a little demitasse cup. But when you think about it, it's basically potato leek soup or, you know, a potato soup in a little cup.
Interesting. Coleman, thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
Coleman Andrews has written The Country Cooking of Ireland. Now, you have got to have a proper Culcannon. It's the mix of mashed potatoes and greens with good, good butter. Find Coleman's Culcannon recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. When we're told by our doctors we can't eat certain things like gluten, why is it that bread and pasta are all we can think of? I mean, why don't we look at all the good foods we can enjoy? Well, the fact is, change doesn't come easily to we humans, which writer Peter Bronski can attest to. He was diagnosed with celiac disease, and he didn't take kindly to it. But after the initial downward spiral, Peter and his wife, a professional baker no less, started building a way of life around the foods they loved. What they learned is in their book, Artisanal Gluten-Free Cooking. Peter Bronski, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Peter, was there something that after realizing you couldn't have anything with gluten in it, was there some food that you really learned to love?
I'd say it was really a category of foods. Particularly on the baking side, we don't realize how pigeonholed our baking is because it's so dependent on gluten, and that comes primarily from wheat.
Right.
And we use wheat flour in so much of what we make. When you start looking at gluten-free baking, it forces you to become introduced to a lot of alternative grains, some of which are considered the ancient grains, like quinoa, millet, amaranth, and then other more common grains like sorghum or other flours like corn or potato or bean flours. And so really you open up this entire spectrum of flours at your disposal that you all of a sudden start using in gluten-free baking that you might not have if you had continued to be a gluten eater.
But can you get the same effect with those things?
It's a challenge initially. There's no one-to-one substitute. You can't remove a wheat-based flour and substitute a single gluten-free flour like rice flour and achieve the same effect. Typically, what you would need to do is create a blend of gluten-free flours drawing from multiple grain sources. And then oftentimes, you may include a gum, like we use xanthan gum in our gluten-free flour blend. And the xanthan gum imparts certain properties to the flour blend that help it to act a little bit more like a wheat-based flour.
Right. You know, I'd like to talk about what the day-to-day life is like for you. For instance, how do you navigate in restaurants?
Well, restaurants are a mixed bag. It certainly has gotten much easier now than it was even just a few short years ago when I was initially diagnosed. More and more restaurants are offering gluten-free menus. The servers and the kitchen staff are trained in preparation of foods for people with allergies or conditions like celiac disease. But it can be a little bit of a gauntlet because it's a two-part hazard. One is what is in the food that's on your plate. But the other part of it is how was that food handled and prepared in the kitchen? Because cross-contamination is as much a concern in a restaurant setting as is the actual ingredients of the food you're eating.
So you're saying, for instance, if somebody dusted the board with flour to roll out a dough, that board would have to be scrupulously clean before somebody, I don't know, cut vegetables on it.
Absolutely. Many restaurants that are catering to the needs of gluten-free diners may dedicate a particular kitchen station to preparing only gluten-free foods so that they fully minimize the opportunity for cross-contamination.
What about Asian restaurants? I mean, I'd imagine they'd be a good bet.
Yeah, in general, that's a great summarization. The one caution to be aware of is with the soy sauce, because most commercial soy sauces are a blend of soy and wheat.
Uh-huh.
You would need to use a tamari wheat-free soy sauce, but otherwise, that's absolutely true. It's traditionally a wheat-free, rice-based kind of cuisine.
Peter, what about the supermarket? Because I'm thinking about all of the ingredients, and they're really subtle, that are in so many foods that could cause some problems.
You certainly need to become a quick expert in reading ingredients labels, because it may not always be listed directly as wheat or barley. But if you're looking at cereals, barley malt is a common ingredient. Wheat isn't always directly declared, although now with the new food allergen labeling laws, if a product contains wheat, it should have a declaration on the label. But you end up doing a lot of shopping on the periphery of a grocery store. Fresh fruits and vegetables, whole meats and fish, dairy are all naturally gluten-free, and it's really the processed foods that comprise the bulk in the center of our supermarkets that really pose the most challenge. Increasingly, we're seeing more and more gluten-free specialty products hitting the market,
right?
And supermarkets are typically responding to that in one of two ways. They'll either integrate them into the supermarket, so you might find gluten-free cereals in the cereal aisle, or they'll segregate the gluten-free products into a special section of the market, so you might be able to go to a gluten-free aisle and find all of those specialty products there in one place.
All right, I'm suspicious by nature. When it says gluten-free on the label, am I guaranteed that that is gluten-free?
No, you're rightly suspicious, because although in the United States gluten-free labeling laws are coming down the pipeline, they're not official yet. And so companies are using the gluten-free label based on their own varying definitions. And so what means gluten-free to one company may not be the same for another. Some may use that definition only for foods that are free of gluten-containing ingredients but are processed in the same facility as wheat-based ingredients or wheat-based foods. And so there may be a concern about cross-contamination there. Other companies may produce their gluten-free foods with gluten-free ingredients in a dedicated facility, and they may test their products for gluten to certify them at a gluten-free level. And so there's a wide variety of foods that may all fall under that same banner of gluten-free, but they'll carry different risks in terms of what might be the potential for cross-contamination.
I think I'm going to stick to the periphery. Hey, Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Peter Bronski is co-author of Artisanal Gluten-Free Cooking. Now, you can get Peter's recipe for Belgian waffles and for that special gluten-free flour mix. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, in Taiwan, what is the latest way to eat for beauty and perpetual youth? This is really obscure. We're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or get to us online via splendidtable.org. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, in Taiwan, what's the latest way to eat for beauty and perpetual youth? Well, apparently you need to eat a new rice. It's being developed at Taiwan's Asia University. It's named AU No. 1 Purple Rice. And even though it is dark, dark red, it supposedly will whiten skin. Now, this is how it works. Bred into the rice are antioxidants that lighten skin. And then you have the grain's outer layer, the rice bran. AU No. 1 Purple Rice's bran is 40 times more effective than vitamin C in slowing down aging. Now, for farmers, the rice plant is super sturdy in rough weather, and to boot, its yield beats out other rices by 30%. Great news for farmers, bad news for plastic surgeons.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? then. Yeah, well, you shall call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
It is time for your calls. We can talk. Let's open up the lines. You can get to us at 800-537-5252 or email at splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is up. Brandy's on the phone from Jackson, Tennessee. Brandy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I called about cooking with ghee.
The clarified butter.
Exactly. The annoying butter that takes 20 minutes for about 2 tablespoons worth.
Yeah, that.
I just bought a Indian cookbook, and of course, almost every single dish in it, it says, you know, begin with ghee.
Right.
But then in parentheses, it says, you know, you can use vegetable oil or extra virgin olive oil to replace
it. I don't know
it.
If I'd use extra virgin olive oil because I don't think it ever existed in India. But anyway, okay. All right. A little disagreement here. Yes. But go on.
And I was just wondering, you know, how important is it to use ghee, or is it just really one of those things, you know, you can use vegetable oil, you don't have to make this stuff, or am I never going to get the authentic taste and flavor if I don't use it?
I think, first of all, it depends where in India the recipes come from. And I don't consider myself a great expert on Indian food, but I know there are parts of India, especially in the south, where coconut oil might be used or other oils, palm oil. The key here is ghee has a delicious flavor. There's no question about it. But there's also the concern over saturated fats. I think when the ghee is a big part of the recipe, yeah, you want to use ghee. Now, you could cut it with something like an expeller press canola oil. In so many words, a healthy oil that is relatively flavorless, and you use maybe half and half.
Okay.
But I do a lot of Indian-inspired cooking, and I use things like canola. And I don't think I'm sacrificing a great deal of flavor. Oh, now, I know Indian cooks might be jumping up and down right now, but between the spicing and all the other techniques that are used in the cooking, like, you know, you make a flavor paste maybe of garlic and spices and onion, and then you fry it in fat until almost all the moisture is evaporated and it's just those spices and those flavorings starting to, you know, saute in the oil. That does so much for flavor that if that oil were flavorless, it's not going to make a big, big difference. So it depends.
Okay.
The short answer is it depends on the recipe. If it's mainly ghee and not a lot of other ingredients, yeah, I'd say go to the trouble to use ghee. And by the way, ghee keeps for a long time. So you could do, you know, several pounds of butter. And you could freeze part of the ghee or keep it in the refrigerator. A lot of people just keep it at room temperature. I refrigerate it. But it's going to keep for quite a while.
Oh, well, that helps me a lot.
Yeah,
I definitely
yeah.
don't mind making it if it's going to keep.
And freeze it in small quantities so that, you know, you can pull out. One of the tricks I used to use with it was I would put it in the old-fashioned ice cube trays. And then
That's so neat.
I'd pop out the frozen cubes and throw them in a plastic bag. And put that in the freezer, and then I could pull out, because an ice cube is generally about 2 tablespoons.
It's individually packaged.
Exactly. So if you can find an ice cube tray with, you know, more or less a standard size ice cube. By the way, you can do that with egg whites, because the average egg white is 2 tablespoons. That's what you get from a large egg, which is a pretty standard measurement in cooking. And so you can just pop your frozen egg white out, and off you go. So that should help you. That should help you out.
Definitely. You've helped me a lot. You've answered so many questions in this 5-minute conversation. Well, thank you, Lynn.
Well, thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it. I love the Splendid Table. I love NPR. I want to work for NPR someday. So,
well, thank you. Thank
I
you for the kind words.
Radio.
Bravo. Thank you.
You have a great day.
You too. Take care, Brandy. Bye.
Bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252. By the way, ghee is made by essentially melting butter Okay. And what happens is the natural oil in the butter separates from the solids and you get this golden liquid. And then you just let that liquid cook until those solids start to turn golden and they give it a wonderful flavor. And then you let it cool and you just skim off the solids and you really have solids at the bottom, solids at the top. And in the middle, the clear oil is the ghee. It freezes beautifully. No problem. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. Well, we got an email from John in Nashville, and he says that he and his wife never have the same work schedule 2 weeks in a row. They work different shifts, and it makes it really hard for them to cook and have some really good eating most nights of the week. So he wants to know, what can they cook in bulk and freeze? Well, John, the best things to do are stews and braises, okay? So this means almost anything that's cooked in liquid, whether it's liquid to cover or liquid to really moisten generously, is going to hold up really well, it's going to reheat well, and it's going to freeze beautifully. And also, what you can do, of course, is break it out into portions, and you can heat it up really fast. So for instance, if you were to take chicken thighs and take a bunch of them and brown them under the broiler, put them into a deep pot, cut up some rutabaga, cut up turnips, cut up sweet potatoes, throw some of your favorite herbs into the pot, put in some red wine, cook that down, add some broth to cover, and just let that simmer. Then you can divide it up, you can freeze it, and you reheat it whenever you feel like it. The other thing is soups, which are really the stew idea watered down even further. But the other thing I like are bean soups, where I start out with dried beans. I let them soak an hour maybe, and I cook them with a saute of celery, carrot, and onion, so they already taste great. And at that point, I can add vegetables. I can add herbs. I can even add things like chipotle chili, which is absolutely fabulous. So that's the basic idea. If it's cooked in some kind of liquid, it's going to freeze really well and it's going to reheat beautifully. And thanks for the email. You can email us, splendidtable.org, or you can use the phone. Call us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is waiting patiently? We got Jennifer calling from Queens, New York. Jennifer, how are you? What do you want to do?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good.
Good. Great. I received a wonderful present for my birthday from my husband. He gave me 27 spice tins that you've put a magnet on and attached to the fridge.
Oh, what a great idea.
I am looking for creative ways to fill those with other than things in the obvious spices like the cumin and the cinnamon, and what are some must-haves and maybe some unique uses for them.
Okay. Well, first of all, ground spices and leaf herbs have about a 3-month shelf life, and they should be kept away from light and from heat, and they've got to be airtight. Now, if your refrigerator gets warm, the side of it, you may want to stick them somewhere else.
Okay.
Okay, because if they're warm, they're going to be toast really fast.
Okay. And
so the idea would be you want to fill them or, you know, put in them what you're going to use fairly quickly.
Right.
Okay? So I would start out, you need peppercorns.
Okay.
That's essential. You know, from there on in, it depends on how you cook. What kind of stuff do you like to eat and do you generally make?
We do a lot of, I like to experiment with all different types of ethnic foods. So whether it's Mexican, Latin, Indian.
Okay.
I have celiacs, so we don't really do a lot of pasta.
Right, I understand.
We do a lot of other grains and beans and legumes and stuff.
Okay, then I think this is what you want to do. Have you ever tried grinding your own spices?
You know, I haven't because I haven't wanted to mess up my coffee grinder, but I thought about getting another one just for that use.
It's a brilliant idea because, boy, I have to tell you, when you grind your own spices, and, you know, you can grind, like, for instance, if you know you use a lot of cumin, I use a lot of cumin, I'll, when I think of it, grind up a bunch and then stick it in a, you know, seal it up. And, and then I'll use it in a week. And then I'll grind some more. But the point being, grinding your own is going to make a big difference. And whole spices, cumin, coriander, allspice, all of that will keep much longer. And when you grind them fresh, they're going to taste like nothing on earth.
Oh, really? They're that much different, huh?
Oh, they are. They are. You're going to see. They're alive. So I would do cumin, coriander. Okay. Do you use allspice at all?
I have it. I don't really know what to use it for, though.
You know, anywhere you use cumin and coriander, if you're doing Moroccan, if you're doing Mexican, if you're doing anything in the Middle East,
okay.
If you're doing anything with basil, believe it or not, or tomato, oh.
Okay.
A little allspice is not a bad thing. It kind of disappears, but it backs up. It gives a kind of warm backdrop.
Okay,
so I would
great.
Do that. I would do some dry leaf basil because sometimes, even if you like using fresh, you can use the leaf, the dry basil, the whole leaf basil, when you start the sauté of a dish and then add the fresh toward the end of cooking so it's bright. So you get a layer of kind of this, you know, basil character, and then you get this bright, fresh expression of it.
Oh, great. Okay.
And you could do that with dry thyme as well. And another thing you tend to use dry more than fresh is oregano.
Okay.
And, you know, there's Mexican oregano, there's Greek oregano, so you can have a ball with the oreganos.
Right. Okay. And, did you ever use Herbes de Provence?
Yes. Yes. That blend, you can also make your own blend, but yes, that blend is fabulous.
Okay. So if you, and what you, kind of things would you use that for?
You would use that probably in beans. Would be great. Absolutely wonderful on things like lamb. Some people will actually mix some with scrambled eggs. Great in tomato sauces.
Okay.
Now, if you want to make your own blend, that would be thyme, oregano, savory, which is a leaf herb, which resembles thyme.
Okay.
Basil. Some people will use lavender.
Okay.
Okay. And that's sort of the mix. And rosemary.
Okay.
Rosemary.
Okay.
So this is what you should do. Think about what you use in your recipes. Look at kind of what you use, and that's what should go in your tins. And if you're going to try something new, get a very small amount of it.
Okay. Great. Excellent. Thanks so much for your ideas.
You are welcome. And you take care. Enjoy the gift. It sounds like a great
one. I will. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye, Jennifer.
Bye-bye.
Now, you can reach us 800-537-5252 or go to the website splendidtable.org. So you live in a city and you're trying to eat local. Urban farmers are taking over vacant lots, but how about a vertical farm, as in a skyscraper? Even before the urban farmer trend took hold, Columbia University researcher Dixon Despommiers was working out the idea of a vertical farm. He joins us from New York. Dixon, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Can you explain exactly what the vertical farm is?
Sure. It's just a high-rise greenhouse. That's basically the idea. It sounds pretty simple, and actually it is. But to execute this requires lots of integration of technologies that haven't been done yet. So the very first vertical farms will be prototypes and probably situated on ag school campuses and maybe associated also with colleges of technology like MIT or CIT.
Right.
And then turn those scientists loose and let them integrate the systems, and the next thing you know, you'll have a vertical farm.
So you're talking about if there's a 30-story skyscraper, there are 30 different floors growing plants.
Yeah, that's the ultimate dream, is to advance that idea so that we can construct them at any level we want and grow anything we want.
But, I mean, we're talking about keeping them warm in the winter and having light source.
Yep.
Even when, you know, light is scarce at certain seasons. And that's where I wonder about the power issue. You know,
Sure. We have two, of course, and we want to start simple. So if you locate the vertical farms in places that are blessed with lots of sunlight, say, for instance, the Middle East or the American Southwest, then the construction of these buildings becomes one of just trying to design it as transparent as you can do it, and also with double or triple skinned glazing, so that it forms a nice insulation. In fact, you have to insulate the building anyway to keep out the bugs.
Right.
So as long as you're doing that, you might as well design it in a way that you don't need a lot of heat and you don't need a lot of cooling in order to make life comfortable, not only for the plants, but for the people who work in that building.
You know, one statistic I read says that in 40 years, 80% of the world's people will live in cities.
That's correct.
Can this kind of farm system feed people on that scale?
I'm convinced that it can. Urban farming is becoming a very, very seductive path that people have taken.
Yeah.
They want to live in the city, but they still want to grow their own food. And so I've seen a lot of examples like that here in New York City with rooftop gardens that not only make decorative plants available now, but also if you cover them over and make them into greenhouses, you can actually raise fruits and vegetables this way as well. So I think we're almost there now.
Mm-hmm. So I can just see a New York building with extra floors.
That's right. Let's think of some sites in New York City that it would be very amenable for this, that are very cheap properties that are going begging for use,
right,
that could capture a lot of sunlight, certainly wind power, and tidal power, too. And that is out in Floyd Bennett Air Force Base in New York City. That's 2.5 square miles of unused property.
Hmm.
So, and we've got Governor's Island. That's another place.
Right.
And they've got tides that come in and out twice a day over a 24-hour period.
Yeah.
There's no reason in the world why you couldn't hook up some kind of a turbine system to capture that energy and feed that into the farm and make it zero carbon footprint in terms of energy use. And you know what? If you were to design them like these offshore oil drill rigs,
right,
you could situate them in the middle of the harbor.
What a great idea. And then you could say you have an East River tomato.
That's right. And there's no land use. And lots of sun and lots of wind.
Dixon, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Dixon Depamier is professor of public health in environmental sciences and microbiology at Columbia University. His article, The Rise of Vertical Farms, was published in Scientific American in November 2009. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And let me leave you with this thought from Alfred Austin, who said, "Exclusiveness in a garden is a mistake as great as it is in society." Splendid Table is distributed by American Public Media. Now, you'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.